Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The occupied territories are segregated. The jurors segregated. It's not, you know, hard to understand. There are different signs for where different people can go. There are different license plates forbidding different people from going different places. Now, what the authorities will tell you is that this is a security measure. But if you go back to the history of Jim Crow in this country, they would tell you the exact same thing.
As Israel's slaughter in Gaza enters its second year, and as Israel sends more troops into Lebanon, we speak to the prize-winning author and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates about his new book, The Message, based in part on a trip he took last year to the occupied West Bank and Israel.
And we were driving out of East Jerusalem into the West Bank, and you know, you could see the settlement, and they would point out the settlement, and it suddenly dawned on me that I was in a region of the world where some people could vote and some people could not. And that was obviously very, very familiar to me.
We'll talk to Ta-Nehisi Coates about his trip to Israel and Palestine, as well as traveling to Senegal, where he visited the slave trade memorial on Gorée Island, and his trip to South Carolina, where school officials tried to ban his award-winning book, Between the World and Me. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, another 25 Palestinians have been killed as Israel's unrelenting war on the besieged Palestinian territory enters its second year. On Monday night, Israeli strikes in central Gaza hit houses in the Barej refugee camp in the city of Deir al-Balah, killing 5 children and 2 women.
The war is against civilians and children, women, the elderly. Who is this war against? What do we have in the Gaza Strip? Do we have aircraft carriers at sea or F-35 planes? What do we have? We have always been unarmed people. All Arab and European countries know that. We are oppressed and lost our rights.
With the latest killings, the official death toll from 1 year of Israel's war is approaching 42,000, according to Gaza's health ministry. That would mean Israeli attacks have killed 1 out of every 55 people living in Gaza, though the figure is likely significantly higher. More than 16,700 of the dead are children. In the occupied West Bank, the Palestinian Prisoners Society says Israeli forces detained another 30 Palestinians overnight during raids on Hebron, Nablus, Bethlehem, and occupied East Jerusalem. The group reports Israel's arrested more than 11,200 Palestinians across the West Bank in the past year. On Monday, 2 West Bank Palestinians were killed in separate Israeli raids. 12-year-old Hatem Reith was fatally shot in the abdomen by Israeli forces in a raid on the Kalandia refugee camp. And in the city of Dura, Israeli troops fatally assaulted 66-year-old Ziad Abu Halil as they raided his home to arrest his brother. His widow, Basma, recounted the fatal assault.
We were asleep at 4 a.m. when the army surrounded the house and arrested my son. They took him out of the house. His father wanted to run after him, but they didn't let him. They pushed the door into him, and he fell and died. He became a martyr. We called the ambulance, and it didn't arrive.
Israel's expanded its attacks on southern Lebanon as it continues to strike Beirut's suburbs. The Israeli military said it's deployed more troops into southwest Lebanon, which followed intense overnight bombardment. In response, Hezbollah has launched a series of missile attacks into northern Israel, including the city of Haifa. Meanwhile, Israel's issued expulsion orders to about a quarter of the population on Lebanon's southern coastline ahead of a planned maritime attack. This all comes as the World Health Organization has expressed concern over intensifying Israeli attacks on healthcare workers and hospitals across Lebanon, which have so far forced the closure of at least 5 healthcare facilities. The WHO is also warning of disease outbreaks due to the overcrowded conditions in shelters for displaced people. In Dearborn, Michigan, thousands of mourners gathered at the Islamic Center of America Sunday to remember Haj Kamel Ahmed Jawad, a 56-year-old husband, father of 4, and Lebanese-American, killed by an Israeli airstrike on his hometown of Nabatea, Lebanon, a week ago. Jawad's family says he'd chosen to remain near the city's main hospital to help the elderly, disabled, and those who couldn't afford to flee Israel's bombs. In a statement, his daughter, Nadine Jawad, wrote, "His life is one of over 50,000 lost at the hands of Israeli aggression across the Middle East. The fact that he was an American citizen should not make his story more important than others. As Muslims, we believe that every life matters. If my dad's story stands out to you, every other civilian murdered by the Israeli regime should as well," she said. A state of emergency has been declared in dozens of Florida counties, and evacuations are underway as residents brace for Hurricane Milton. The Category 4 storm is expected to make landfall Wednesday, bringing life-threatening storm surges, devastating winds, and torrential rain to Florida's Gulf Coast, including Tampa Bay, just 2 weeks after the region was battered by Hurricane Helene. Local crews are scrambling to haul most of the debris left behind by Helene's destruction ahead of Milton, which is expected to grow larger today as it grazes Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. On Monday, veteran meteorologist John Morales of Miami broke down on live TV as Hurricane Milton temporarily strengthened into a Category 5 storm over the Gulf of Mexico.
Just an incredible, incredible, incredible hurricane. It has dropped. It has dropped 50 millibars in 10 hours. I apologize. This is just horrific. It is just gaining strength in the Gulf of Mexico, where you can imagine the winds, I mean, the seas are just so incredibly, incredibly hot, a record hot, as you might imagine. You know what's driving that. I don't need to tell you. Global warming, climate change, leading to this and becoming an increasing threat.
Milton is one of the fastest intensifying storms ever recorded in the Atlantic. Its approach comes as the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is facing severe staff shortages, with just about 9% of its workers, or about 1,200 people, available to respond to Hurricane Milton. Georgia's Supreme Court reinstated the state's 6-week abortion ban Monday, 1 week after a lower court struck down the ban, ruling it unconstitutional. Alice Wang from the Center for Reproductive Rights said, quote, "This ban has already killed multiple women, as the state's own Maternal Mortality Review Committee found last month." Yet Attorney General Carr rushed to court to reinstate this ban, ensuring more lives will be lost, unquote. And another blow to abortion rights. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled Monday Texas doctors cannot be compelled to perform emergency abortions if the procedure is deemed to violate Texas's abortion ban. The far-right-led Supreme Court, which overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, rejected the Biden administration's invocation of the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, EMTALA, which requires health providers to intervene if a patient's life is at risk. In Colorado, former Mesa County Clerk Tina Peters was sentenced to 9 years in prison for crimes she committed in the wake of the 2020 election, as she peddled false claims about rigged voting machines following Donald Trump's loss. District Judge Matthew Barrett castigated Peters as he handed down her sentence last Thursday.
"You are no hero. You abused your position, and you're a charlatan who used and is still using your prior position in office to peddle a snake oil that's been proven to be junk time and time again.
Since last week's sentencing, Judge Barrett and court staff report they've received threats. Tina Peters is the first election official to be convicted of criminal charges for attempting to overturn the 2020 election based on right-wing conspiracy theories. In labor news, some 600 workers at two Hilton hotels in Boston have gone on strike, joining thousands of others in at least four other U.S. cities who've walked off the job demanding higher wages, better staffing, and fair workloads. Those striking include housekeepers, front desk agents, cooks, dishwashers, servers, bartenders, bellhops, and door attendants. A total of more than 4,700 hotel workers with the Unite Here union are currently on strike at Hilton, Hyatt, and Marriott hotels in Boston, Honolulu, San Diego, and San Francisco. In Tunisia, incumbent President Kais Saied won Sunday's election with some 90% of the vote. The turnout was less than 29%, as Saied's critics called for a boycott of the election, which came after the president orchestrated a widespread crackdown on dissent, jailing political rivals, journalists, lawyers, and activists. Since coming to power 3 years ago, Saied dissolved parliament, dismantled Tunisia's judiciary, and rewrote the constitution, what's been described as a coup. Ahead of the vote last Friday, protesters rallied in Tunis. This is the renowned filmmaker Ibrahim Latif.
Today we had to go out despite the unfortunate fact that the election results are almost predetermined. However, this anger must continue until we stop the bleeding that affects rights and freedoms.
And here in New York, Jewish activists and allies gathered Monday for a vigil on the first anniversary of October 7th. To mourn Israelis and Palestinians who've been killed and call for an end to the Israeli massacre in Gaza and beyond. Participants performed prayers, read out the names of those whose lives have been lost. Democracy Now! Spoke to Eva Borgwardt of the group If Not Now! At the vigil.
So the motto is Every Life, a Universe, and it's from Pikuach Nefesh, which says that to destroy a life is to destroy an entire world, and to save a life is to save an entire world. And our government is not treating every single life as a universe. They're treating Palestinian lives as less sacred.
That was Eva Borgwardt, national spokesperson of the group If Not Now!. Another speaker who joined a later rally of Israeli Americans who are relatives of hostages in Gaza also spoke.
My name is Adi, and I'm an Israeli American. A year ago, I was here in New York with my mother, anxiously texting our family in Be'eri as they were trapped in their homes, listening to the sounds of a massacre outside. Abandoned by the Israeli government to fend for themselves. My uncle was murdered, together with 100 other kibbutz members, and 31 members were kidnapped to Gaza. The brutality did not start a year ago, but for me and most of the people I know from my region in the world, this year was like a magnifying glass to the unimaginable damage of oppression, occupation, war, and violence. Now take this loss as I feel today and multiply it by millions and millions. The millions of Palestinians, Lebanese, Israelis, Iranians, millions of hundreds who lost lives, lost one, loved ones, body functions, their homes, food, shelter, things with sentimental values, a million little connections lost forever. I want to scream. Scream. None of them are my enemy. I want nothing but peace and healing for all of them.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, prize-winning author and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates on his new book, The Message. He traveled to the occupied West Bank in Israel, to South Carolina, and to Senegal. Ta-Nehisi Coates for the hour. Stay with us. Many suggestions and documents.
Freedom is written.
Reparations on My Soul by Gil Scott-Heron. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Vigils and memorials were held across the globe Monday and this weekend on the first anniversary of October 7th. To mourn Israelis and Palestinians who've been killed over the past year. The anniversary comes as Israel's widening its assault on Gaza and sending more troops into Lebanon. Today we spend the hour with the acclaimed writer, the journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of the new book, The Message, based in part on a trip he took last year to the occupied West Bank in Israel. Ta-Nehisi compares Israel's apartheid system to that of Jim Crow here in the United States. He writes, "It occurred to me that there was still one place on the planet under American patronage that resembled the world that my parents were born into." In his book, Ta-Nehisi Coates also writes about traveling to Senegal, where he visited the slave trade memorial at Gori Island, and going to South Carolina, where school officials tried to ban his book, Between the World and Me, which won the National Book Award in 2015. The Message is written as a letter to his students at Howard University, where Ta-Nehisi Coates is the Sterling Brown Endowed Chair in the English Department. The Message is Ta-Nehisi's first collection of nonfiction work since his 2017 book, We Were 8 Years in Power, an American Tragedy. Ta-Nehisi, welcome back to Democracy Now! Last time and during the pandemic, you were in another studio, so it's great to be with you in our New York studio. I wanted to read one of your quotes. "We're plagued by dead language and dead stories that serve people whose aim is nothing short of a dead world. It's not enough to stand against these dissemblers. There has to be something in you, something that hungers for clarity. You'll need that hunger because if you follow that path soon enough, you'll find yourself confronting not just their myths, not just their stories, but your own." Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Message. We're going to talk a lot about what's happening in the occupied territories in Gaza, in the West Bank. But I wanted to start where you go in The Message first, and that is to Senegal.
Right.
Talk about this journey that you actually took with great trepidation.
I did. As you said, you know, we'll spend a lot of time talking about the occupied territories in Israel and the West Bank, but it's good to start here because the two parts are kind of paired to each other. African Americans are a group of people who have lived under the weight of artifice, a creation, a kind of mythology of what Africa is in our minds. If all of the myths of racism, all the justifications for enslavement, all the justifications for Jim Crow, at the end of the day, they have their origins in these constructions of Africa as this savage place, the idea that, you know, having been brought here, we're better off. Very, very typical of, you know, colonizing and conquering movements. And one of the things we've done to push back is create our own narratives, our own journeys, our own ideas of what Africa is. My very name comes out of that, which I'm very uncomfortable with, as I talk about in the book. And
talk about it.
Oh, boy. Oh, Lord. I wrote it. I should be very comfortable talking about it. You know, I was born in 1975. And that was a period in time coming out of Black Power, coming out of, you know, Black is Beautiful, like really discovering this idea that our sense of beauty, our nose, our lips, our names, our hair, that we had the right to take control over that, including our history. And so my name is an ancient Egyptian name that refers to the ancient kingdom of Nubia. The notion was that, put very, very crudely, that if the West had its kings and queens, if it had its great monuments, if it had its great ideas, so did we. And part of growing older, part of, you know, and I actually talk about this in Between the World and Me, part of becoming a writer, actually, is like our job is to be skeptical of clean stories. And I learned that very, very early on. And the message is kind of a continuation of that. Of course, the ultimate, I would say, I guess, climax in that journey is going to see the continent itself. And moving past myth, moving past the idea of constructed narratives, even when they're liberatory, even when they're emancipationists, to see the people themselves. And that is what took me to Dakar. And that is what I think took so long for me to go to Dakar.
And in terms of what most surprised you in the trip, could you talk about that?
Yeah, which most surprised me is the thing that will not surprise any African-American watching this interview. It was my deep sorrow. It was my deep, deep, deep sorrow. And I think, like, much of what I've, you know, just said in answer to Amy's question, I'd already intellectualized before I went. And so I was already thinking about this, but thinking about something and being confronted with it is a totally, totally different thing. It's a great Mike Tyson said, everybody's got a plan until they got punched. And as soon as that plane started descending out of the clouds over Dakar and I saw the buildings rising up, I was being punched. It is one thing to think about the Middle Passage, to think about your ancestors theoretically. It is quite another to literally sit on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean and look out and understand that this was, even if only symbolically, last stop.
And when you went to Gore, you decided that you did not want to have any of the tour guides.
No.
You wanted to wander around on your own.
No, but
talk about that experience.
By then, it was like day three, and so I understood that as much as I thought I was going to see the continent, I was actually going to see some sort of departed version of myself, you know, from hundreds of years ago. I was walking with ghosts the whole time, and I didn't want to be talked to. My family is from the eastern shore of Maryland, not too far from Ocean City, for anybody who knows that geography. It's like right on the Atlantic Ocean. And so to get back to Senegal, to get to Dakar, which is itself right on the tip of the continent, you know, I would look out and I would have these moments and I would say, my God, you know what I mean? There's part of me all the way on the other side and there's part of me that's here. And so, again, Gore is a place that has a lot of story and a lot of myth around it. And I read about that. I thought I was fully prepared. But I'm going to tell you, brother, you get on that boat and that boat pulls off and you think about all of your ancestors. And it was 7 a.m. in the morning and I was alone on that boat. And it is a very, very different experience.
And back to your name, Ta-Nehisi,
yes.
And also which goes to your parents as well,
yes.
And how their influence on you. Your dad, a former Black Panther, ran a publishing publishing press right in your house.
Yeah. No, and I think like what they were really trying to do, and this actually goes to the core of what the book is about. How do you tell your own story? How do you free yourself from a history, from novels, from film, from television, an entire architecture that is designed to tell you that you are exactly where you belong because of who you are, because of what you are, either because of your genes, because God said, you know, you belong there. How do you construct something different? And one of the things I'm trying to confront in the book is, I think perhaps step one is almost to make a mirror image of the people that have put you in that situation. Well, you say with this, we're actually that. But I think one of the most difficult things is to free yourself entirely of that structure and to construct your own morality, your own stories, your own ideas that don't necessarily depend on those who have put you in the situation to begin with.
And the structure of your book is addressed to your students at Howard. The decision to choose that form for your book?
You know, I was, to be honest with you, I've not said this anywhere. I was very worried about that because I'd done that. Like, I'd written this letter in Between the World and Me, and I thought people could get, oh, my God, he's going to do this again. What, Between the World and Me again? But the fact of the matter is I am always trying to achieve intimacy with the reader. That's the, you know, the primary job. I would tell my students all the time, look, you are dealing with readers who could be doing anything else. They could be on their smartphones. They could be playing video games. They could be watching movies. They could be watching TV. They could be somewhere making love. They could be doing anything but reading you. And so you have a responsibility to make them feel a sense of intimacy and immediacy. And I was lucky in the sense that, you know, these were very, very real conversations that I had with my students. So I had something to pull from, you know, and also, you know, the fact of just the letter form allowed me to do that. It allows me to get, you know, a kind of intimacy with my reader.
Talk about George Orwell, Why I Write, and connecting politics and language in the promise you made to your students at Howard. Your Between the World and Me was written to your son, Samari, This to the students.
Yeah. So we usually start actually with politics in the English language. That's the first essay that I have them read, you know, just to think about language as a political thing. You know, we live in this world where I feel that oftentimes we are taught, not that everybody subscribes to this, that art lives over here and politics lives over here. And that politics itself is actually very, very limited, that, you know, it happens every 2 or 4 years. It's in the voting booth. It's who you decide, you know, to vote for. It's what issues you decide to activate on. But one of the arguments that I make in the message is that there's an entire architecture outside of the world of mean politics that determines how politicians actually talk, the choices they give, you know, et cetera. Why does Kamala Harris feel the need, for instance, to say that she has a gun? What is that actually based on? And I would say it is based on archetypes of femininity. I would say it's built based on archetypes of race, archetypes of the cowboy. And where do those archetypes come from? They come from our art. They come from our literature. They come from our film, our TVs, our commercials. You know, and at their base, they ultimately come from writing because somebody has to write those ultimately. And in that world, things that seem separated from politics never really are. And so I wanted to start this book, The Message, with that Orwell quote, because that's like one of the things he kind of is obsessing with in that essay. And at the same time, there's this beautiful tension that I often feel, which is in a different world, you know, he would just write beautiful stories. He would just play with language for the hell of playing with language. But he doesn't live in that world. And I don't feel that my students live in that world. They live in a world of, as we'll talk about, genocide, apartheid, segregation, global warming, you know, Category 5 hurricanes, you know, flood on one coast, fire on the other. These are immediate issues. And I don't believe that they as writers, we as writers, have the luxury of sort of sitting back in our salons and in our living rooms, you know, simply constructing beautiful language for the hell of constructing beautiful language. It has to be engaged with something.
From Senegal, you take us to Columbia, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Why that choice?
Well, I was writing this in a time where this wave of book bannings was happening. And I always wanted to write about that. But I felt that I was worried about making the writer the center of the book banning. Because even though the work is directed at the writer, the writer is actually not the person that suffers under the book ban. The teachers suffer under the book ban. It's the teachers who are under threat for losing their job. It's the teachers who get harassed. It's the librarians who are under threat of losing their jobs. It's the librarians who get harassed. It's the students who lose the ability to have access to different worlds and different ways of thinking. And I was trying to figure out how I could write this in such a way so that I would not be the center of it. Luckily, you know, I ended up in conversation with a teacher by the name of Mary Wood from Chapin, South Carolina, went to Chapin High School where she teaches and where she was trying to teach Between the World and Me and got into some amount of trouble for that. And she invited me down, you know, just to, you know, go to a hearing. And that's what I did. And it was quite eventful. It was not the world that I expected. It was not the audience I expected. It was interesting to see how much support actually was rallied behind her, even though she's in a deep red area, in a deep red state. And so that, too, is about the power of stories. That, too, is about the power of narratives, the questions we ask and the questions we don't.
You write in the message about this experience in South Carolina. I see politicians in Colorado and Tennessee and South Carolina moving against my own work, tossing books I've authored out of libraries, banning them from classes. I feel snapped.